electing one judge short while we're waiting for Congress to take up the nomination of a nominated judge. And we have been relying on senior judges and Article III judges to sit in and assist us during this period. And today, we're honored to welcome Senior Judge Dave Sentell of the D.C. Circuit, former Chief Judge of the D.C. Circuit. This is the fourth time that Judge Sentell has sat with our court, 1990, 1991, and 1996. And the interesting item is of the three times that he sat with the court, he authored the opinions twice. So we're honored to have you today and welcome you to the court, Judge Sentell. The court will now hear United States versus Bess. Are counsel ready? Okay, appellant.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Major John Stevens.
Speak up, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
You kind of move that. Yeah, there you go.
May it please the court, my name is Major John Stevens, and I represent the appellant, Petty Officer Pedro Bess. Chief Judge Erdman, with the court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Every accused has the right to challenge the evidence presented against him. After a lengthy trial, the military judge allowed the government to present apparently damning evidence to the members during deliberations. Petty Officer Bess was forced to remain silent while this happened. If the evidence was innocuous, there might not be a problem. But on its face, the evidence appeared to completely undermine Petty Officer Bess's defense and undermine his defense counsel's credibility. This new evidence was several muster reports. One of them appeared to place Petty Officer Bess at the scene of one of the crimes and exclude the only other possible suspect. The government was allowed to use evidence of this crime as evidence for all of the other crimes. When this new unchallenged evidence was presented to the members, Petty Officer Bess's fate was sealed and his trial was unfair. The first issue is on the untrustworthiness of the evidence. In fact, its circumstances and preparation were untrustworthy. Specifically under MRE 8036, this is a condition for admissibility that something has to be trustworthy. The circumstances, the preparation of the document must be trustworthy. Now, if we can set aside quickly the issue of whether it was legally admissible, which we challenge, however, even if the evidence was legally admissible as a matter of law, Petty Officer Bess still had the right to attack the accuracy of this evidence before the fact finder.
Well, what are you saying here? You're starting off talking about trustworthiness as though you're going to whether the hearsay exemption applies or not, and then you say, well, we're not talking about that. What's the core of your argument? I don't think it's that the judge erred in letting it in under the hearsay exception. It's that he didn't get to cross-examine. He didn't get to present anything in response to it.
Precisely.
Am I correct?
No, Judge Stuckey, you're correct. The issue here, because what we're challenging is the trustworthiness of this document, is that that would be a basis for both a legal challenge to its admissibility, but our chief complaint is that Petty Officer Bess,
okay,
regardless of the legal admissibility, never was able to challenge the accuracy of the evidence before the fact finder where it would actually matter. And so what we have with the untrustworthiness of the documents, and the court need not take my word for it, the court can take the government's word for it. The government had decided on two occasions that the circumstances of the preparation of these muster reports were untrustworthy. We know this because during the 39A, when Petty Officer Odom was called, who was one of the individuals who was responsible for submitting these muster reports, he described a situation where there were no face-to-face musters. It was not even possible to have face-to-face musters. He also described situations where the lead petty officers from the various sections in the medical clinics would call around to the lower sections and say, who's there? And he also described where these other people in the clinic would cover for other people. And so instead of marking someone as not present, or in an unauthorized absence capacity, they would mark them in something called a late stay or special detail.
Counsel, putting aside for a moment your argument that they weren't able to present this to the fact finder, aren't those type of issues that you're raising now, don't they go more to the weight? That if the custodian comes in and says that this is the document that she maintains in the normal course of her business, you know, if there are issues that can be raised as to their reliability. Doesn't that go more to weight?
Oh, precisely, Chief Judge Irvin. That does go to the weight, and that is our argument, is that the members, that Petty Officer Bass had the right to present this evidence before the members.
I realize that argument, but I'm just looking now at the admissibility as a business record.
Yes, Your Honor, as far as admissibility goes, that's straight out of 8036, is that and this court has said that trustworthiness is a precondition to admissibility. So we're more focused on that Petty Officer Best did not get to attack the weight. However, we're not seeing any ground that these were not, as a matter of law, legally admissible. We believe that they weren't, but even if the court were to find that the judge did not abuse his discretion and these documents could come in and be presented to the members as a matter of law, we still have a fundamental due process and Sixth Amendment issue with Petty Officer Best not being able to attack the accuracy of that evidence before the finder of fact.
Counsel, assuming that we agree with you that it was error for the military judge to not allow the defense to attack the weight of this evidence in front of the members, why isn't this error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? I mean, he was acquitted of one of the specifications where the muster report indicated that he was present, wasn't he?
No, Judge Ryan. The issue here is really Prosecution Exhibit 30. There were five muster reports. In Prosecution Exhibit 30, this is in essence the smoking gun, as it were, because you have a situation in Prosecution Exhibit 30 which clearly says that the other person is in something called late-stay special detail and that Petty Officer Best is present. Now, on its face, because the documents cannot speak for themselves, other than to show Petty Officer Best was at work that day and Petty Officer Philogene was in something called late-stay special detail, which we can only reasonably assume means not present in some way. We also know that in that particular visit, that was witness B.S., and she told the members that her visit or her exam was in the morning or early afternoon. The documents that are associated with that exam are from 0940 to 1100. So what the members are looking at is they have a witness here, BS, who says that my exam was in the morning or the early afternoon. The associated documents with that exam are sometime in the morning. And then we have Petty Officer Best as present and Petty Officer Philogene as something called late stay special detail. A reasonable conclusion from that is that, well, this places Petty Officer Best there and this excludes Petty Officer Philogene. And because of MRE 404B and the military judge's instruction, we're allowed to take this evidence and we're allowed to say that the identity of the individual x-ray technician can be the same for all of the other ones. Now, it gets us a little bit into speculation about why there were 11 specifications that Petty Officer Best was charged with and he was only convicted of 6. So we get into a little bit of speculation, but the one thing that we believe is not speculation is that this document on its face includes Petty Officer Best and excludes Petty Officer Philogene. And that's what this defense was really about.
To follow up on what Judge Ryan was just pointing out, in regard to Lance Corporal A.A., wasn't there no muster report and a conviction? And then in regard to OLS, there was a muster report, but there was acquittal, indicating that the muster reports really were not dispositive of this issue before the panel.
If I can take, Judge Olson, if I can take Lance Corporal A.A. first and then OLS. And there's two parts of our argument here. First is that we don't think the court should be comfortable in saying there was only a little bit of arsenic in the cake, because we have evidence for one crime, and the court, we believe, should not say, well, that was just this one, and the court would have to speculate to say, well, we're not sure what happened with the other ones. Well, that tie should go to the runner, Judge Olson. But if I can take Lance Corporal A.A. Now, Lance Corporal A.A., she makes, there are only two people that make contemporaneous complaints, and as it were, OLS, the 15-year-old, was the other one. Well, Lance Corporal A.A., is her original report, she went back into the clinic and said, hey, I didn't like the language that this guy used. He said, I almost got you naked for no reason. And that was the substance of her complaint. And this information is coming from four employees at the clinic, because after she made that complaint to the leading petty officer, the leading petty officer gathered up all the employees, including a civilian, and said, look, we have to be a little more professional in the language we use. We have to say things like disrobe or undress. You can't be saying things like this. However, by the time we got to trial a couple years later, as Lance Corporal AA, the substance of her complaint had changed. The substance of her complaint was that this guy was trying to get me undressed. And so if you take the Prosecution Exhibit 30 and the MRE 404B instruction, is that you can transform Lance Corporal AA's complaint into something that looks like, you know, inappropriate language into an attempt to get her naked. And so that's why we think Prosecution Exhibit 30 and the muster reports are damaging to the Lance Corporal AA attempt conviction.
Are you arguing spillover or something analogous to spillover with regard to the instruction? Are you saying that all this stuff just kind of flowed together under the 404B instruction and basically prejudiced him? Is that what you're saying?
A little bit, Judge Stuckey. Now, yes, there was a spillover instruction, as there's always a spillover instruction that competes with the 404B instruction. However, the 404B instruction is specifically saying that you can use this to ascertain the identity, modus operandi, or intent of the person who did this. And so it's hard to say that, well, they followed 404B and they followed spillover. And
are you saying given the instruction was error or what?
Well, the instructions were correct, Judge Stuckey. Yeah. I mean, in fact, there was actually no 404B notice here that the charges themselves served as 404B, but we have no issue with the 404B instruction, just as it would be appropriate to have the spillover instruction. But again, if you have the government able to slip evidence under the deliberation room door that on its face purports to show that Petty Officer Best is the guy that did it and Petty Officer Philogene was nowhere near one of the appointments, then we definitely have a problem. And if Judge Olson, if I can return to OLS, OLS is a bit of a puzzle, and it just shows kind of the fundamental lack of foundation for this entire investigation. Is that OLS, this is done very early on in this time period, and she makes the complaint. Her mother calls the clinic the next day, speaks with Petty Officer Bess, and then at trial she says, well, you know, somewhere I decided that the guy who was my technician had a foreign accent, which Petty Officer Philogene did, and this seems to be this weird red herring. But again, that gets us a little bit of speculation, but I think that the issue with OLS is that she just wasn't confident about identifying Petty Officer Bess and wasn't maybe a credible witness, because again, Petty Officer Bess says, I was her technician, but you know, I talked with her mom the day after. Her mom seemed, you know, at least placated somewhat, and what she said happened just did not happen.
So with that, it's a red herring, but in the other instances, in your view, the muster reports were dispositive of the convictions?
Well, we think so, Judge Olson. Again, with Prosecution Exhibit 30, is that clearly says that Best was there and Philogene wasn't. Now, the other four muster reports...
what do you do about the eyewitness identification and the medical records?
Thank you, Judge Ryan. What I'd like to get to on the eyewitness identification, starting with that, is the government's case is sort of a three-legged stool. And those three legs, the first is the eyewitness identification of four witnesses of the seven, the identity is issued. So we have the eyewitness identification. The second leg of that stool is the CHCS reports. And the third leg of that stool are the X-ray markers. And if I can address Judge Ryan's question about the eyewitness identifications. Well, the thing about the identifications is that, first of all, they're not contemporaneous reports about anything. And so these witnesses were sought out by the government through these CHCS reports, where they used Bess's name in the report to target somebody that had had an exam. Petty Officer Bess, at least per the reports, had done the exam. And so the first one is PG. Now, PG, she admitted to making a false statement about the civilian employee, Mr. Rosenthal, on the stand. She needed about half an hour after she started crying when she was cross-examined that, hey, you made a false statement against Mr. Rosenthal to NCIS. And she said yes. Moreover, is that all of the eyewitness identifications, the first ones take place at the Article 32 where Petty Officer Bess is flanked by his counsel, sitting at defense counsel table, 15 and a half months after a 15, 20-minute exam.
But counsel, isn't it different if you've got a situation with a court-martial where an incident occurs and there's the universe of the, out there that could have been identified as the individual, and then you've got a suggestive situation as compared to a very small population who was involved in these procedures at that time?
Well, that's a fair question, Judge Olson, but we would note that under the relevant case law, a photographic identification, a pretrial photographic identification, like the ones that took place at the 32 and a similar one took place 2 years later at the court-martial, would be inadmissible because it's deemed untrustworthy. So it would have been much better if NCIS had...
Counsel, you made these arguments were made at trial, right, about the eyewitness identifications being unreliable and the time that had lapsed, et cetera, and the trier of fact rejected those arguments and apparently believed the identifiers.
Yes, Judge Ryan. However, we're unable to, we'd have to speculate whether or not the members were able to make that decision just based on the difficulties with eyewitness examination or whether they were aided by this Prosecution Exhibit 30. If we didn't have Prosecution Exhibit 30 or any of the muster reports here, or Petty Officer Best had been allowed to cross-examine the custodian in front of the witness, in front of the members, present witnesses in his own defense, or make a closing argument on all the evidence that was admitted, then we would have had a fair trial. But if we get back to the eyewitness identifications, is a retort might be, well, you know, yes, counsel, that's great that they, you know, these eyewitness identifications weren't necessarily very strong, but you have the situation where this is a traumatic event that has happened. Well, again, these four witnesses where identification happens 15 and a half months later or 2 years later, is that they do not themselves describe any kind of traumatic episode.
Mr. Farr, is just the perhaps inherent fallibility of eyewitnesses, is there anything about that part of the case that's erroneous? You're just making the error occurs, if at all, with respect to the muster reports, right?
Yes, Judge Sintel, that's what we're saying.
I mean, panels in the military and juries in civilian life make decisions based on eyewitness identification all the time, and it's always been a period of time since the events occurred. So I'm not sure what your point is with respect to that.
Well, the point, Judge Sintel, is that we have, again, this three-legged stool. And so we have the eyewitness identifications, which, again, we believe are problematic. Second, we have the CSU.
Well, I don't care if you believe they're problematic. They were eyewitness identifications by sworn witnesses like any other trial, right?
Fair enough, Judge Sintel, but we also had, in essence, an eyewitness identification at OLS. And Petty Officer Best said, I was her technician, and it was not disputed, and yet that results in a full acquittal. So with eyewitness identifications, there may be more than meets the eye there. And so the second prong of the government's case is the CHCS reports, which the government admitted at trial were problematic. I see that my time has expired. All I really want to say in conclusion is that this is essentially an overtime where Petty Officer Best is not allowed to take the field. In the government's case, it could be probable cause or it could be even approach preponderance, but the government cannot say that it's overwhelming. And already at the trial level, the government conceded problems with the evidence. So the government cannot now on appeal say that its case was overwhelming.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Captain Matt Harris, and along with Colonel Mark Jamison, I represent the United States. This Court should affirm the findings and sentence for two reasons. First, the appellant was afforded an opportunity to present a full defense, and second, any error in admitting the muster reports or excluding testimony from anyone was harmless because there was overwhelming evidence to prove that the appellant was the offender. Now, Your Honors, the members are entitled to equal access to the evidence. If the military judge erred here, he erred in refusing to allow the appellant to call HM1 Odom after the muster reports were admitted.
But I have to ask. I'm not always on this court, but I'm always on some court. And I don't recall ever seeing a case in any reports anywhere where a judge has allowed, after the panel or jury has retired, has allowed additional evidence to be introduced by one side and I don't even remember that, let alone not cross-examined by the other party. Is this something that's happened before, or was this judge playing new ground here?
Your Honor, this does seem to be a fairly unique situation. So there's cases like the CCA case, Campbell, where witnesses were called later, and the neither side was able to cross-examine the witness after the member's questions were asked. But that's probably the most factually similar case.
Well, we all agree, I think, that the panel has the right to ask for this evidence.
Yeah.
But is it the government's position that that ability to ask for it somehow relaxes the rules of evidence?
No, Your Honor. Merely that when they asked for non-testimonial business records, and they made that limited request, those items were then provided to the members.
But once the custodian put the date on each of those muster reports, that went a little bit beyond, that was at the request of the prosecution for purposes of trial. And so, you know, that appears to get into the realm of testimonial evidence.
Your Honor, we agree that the dates were written on the documents specifically for this court-martial. However, that date merely reflected the file name of the documents themselves.
Isn't that beside the point? I mean, you're not really going to make the argument that once there's a question as to whether or not these reports are 100% accurate, right, which goes to the weight of the evidence. That the defense should not have, you're not going to make the argument that the defense shouldn't have the opportunity to have the members hear that.
Generally, that's correct, Your Honor. However, in these limited circumstances where
But why do you need to make that argument? I mean, why don't you make the argument about why it is or is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Because, I mean, that's not a credible argument.
Your Honor, we agree that the prejudice argument is our strongest argument here. However, we would simply note that this case is somewhat different from cases like McAllister v. Brewer or McAllister, where the evidence that the appellant was deprived of or was not able to put before the members was central to his defense. In this case, he was able to put on his
defense. Well, wasn't it central to his defense? He's saying you got the wrong guy, and here's a bunch of business records that say we got the right guy. If that isn't central, what is?
Your Honor, the evidence that he desired to put on certainly was an attempt to undermine the reliability of those reports, but it was not something like McAllister where he's got a witness saying this other guy is actually the guy that fired
the shots. I'm where Judge Santel is on this. I've never heard of just plopping the stuff in front of the members and saying we're not going to say anything about this. Here they are, members. You make what it is, whatever you can make out of them. What kind of due process is that?
Your Honor, we agree. It is an unusual process, but
well, I don't care. It may be unusual process. Is it due process?
Yes, Your Honor. Where the appellant was allowed to put on those witnesses that were central to his defense.
Well, he obviously had other stuff he wanted to do, and he objected, and the judge blew him off.
That's correct, Your Honor. The judge did deprive him of the opportunity to put on HM1.
So, as Judge Ryan said, why are you arguing?
Simply because,
I mean, in a situation like this, counsel wouldn't, I mean, it's the government counsel, the trial counsel's duty to protect the record, right? It's not the defense counsel's job. It's not necessarily the judge's job if he is making a mistake, right? So rather than compounding the error of the trial counsel and not making sure that the correct process was followed at trial by arguing that it was okay, why don't you focus on the argument that you think is strongest?
Yes, Your Honor. So the admission of the reports in this case, and more specifically the denial of the opportunity to call Agent 1 Odom to attack the reliability of those reports, what was not harmless here given the exceptional strength of the United States case.
I can't hear you, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. Even though we don't believe this is a confrontation issue, the Van Arsdal factors are instructive as to whether or not prejudice occurred here. So you can look to the importance of the evidence in the United States case. The appellant has suggested that the United States case was a stool with three legs. None of those legs was these muster reports. They were so unimportant that the United States wasn't even trying to admit them into evidence. They were only admitted at the request of the members.
But you did introduce the content of the muster reports. I mean, you didn't introduce the document, but you had the information that is contained in the documents as part of your case.
Your Honor, that information was used to cross-examine the appellant, but it was not actually admitted to the members as evidence. Okay. Now, whether or not it was cumulative, certainly this evidence was cumulative in this case where you've got eyewitness testimony. We agree that there's varying degrees of quality of that eyewitness testimony, but you can take the testimony of Lance Corporal AA, and again, these muster reports are only relevant to the issue of identification. You've got witnesses like AA who provide a solid eyewitness identification, actually went back into the clinic with her friend after the fact, noted the appellant's name, noted his rank and the uniform he was wearing so that she could make complaints about him. Same thing with JE. You've got an exceptionally strong eyewitness identification in that case. They were also able to exclude HM3 Philogen as the offender here by noting that they had dealt with him previously. He had a very strong Haitian accent that was very different from what the appellant had. They were actually able to draw a distinction between the two and demonstrate that it was the appellant, in fact, that was the offender at issue in each of these cases. And with regards to the 404B evidence, that's how it would have been used by the members.
Well, what about Ms. B.S.? She did not identify him.
That's correct, Your Honor. B.S. did not make import visual identification. However, she did note that he didn't have the Haitian accent, and she had had this discussion with him about Granby Street. She wasn't only, hey, remove your clothes, we're going to take some x-rays now. They actually had a conversation about if and when she went out, et cetera. So she had significant interaction with was able to demonstrate that this wasn't somebody speaking in a thick Haitian accent, which all the witnesses agreed HM3 Philogen had, and the members would have noticed when they actually heard HM3 Philogen's testimony. It was also cumulative with the CHCS reports, and we agree that the reports were not perfect, Your Honor, but none of them suggested that any individual but the appellant was the offender here. And in those places where the records should have reflected that it was HM3 Philogen or Mr. Rosenthal who conducted the x-rays, that's who they indicated. So, for example, with PG, where she had been dealing with Mr. Rosenthal, Mr. Rosenthal's name was listed on the reports. Or previously, where Lance Corporal AA had been dealing with with HM3 Philogen, it was HM3 Philogen that was listed on her records as the tech who took the x-rays. And then finally, the markers. Again, not perfect, but none of the markers implicate anybody but the appellant. And to a limited extent, for some of the victims, they do indicate that it was the appellant who took the x-rays. So there was substantial cumulative evidence indicating that the appellant was the offender in this case, even without the muster.
Well, wasn't there a lot of evidence as to the markers that sometimes they appeared, sometimes they didn't appear, sometimes they could be changed? I mean, what?
Yes, Your Honor,
how conclusive is that?
That occasionally techs would use other people's markers, and we agree that the markers alone certainly don't establish that the appellant was the offender in any given case, but it's strong circumstantial evidence supporting the eyewitness identifications and the medical records. Now, as Judge Ryan noted, there was an instance where the muster reports clearly implicated the appellant, this is with OLS, and exculpated HM3 Philogen, and yet the members acquitted. Now, in that case, OLS was not able to make a visual identification of the appellant, and you had this testimony kind of muddying the waters as to whether or not the technician that treated her had a Haitian accent. Now, under those circumstances, it's clear that the members were relying on those eyewitness identifications and on this auditory evidence about the accent that the appellant didn't have and HM3 Philogen did have. So under those circumstances, it's clear that the muster reports were not important to the members' decision and that the convictions would have resulted regardless of whether or not the muster reports were admitted. Now, I'd also like to talk a little bit about what HM1 Odom's testimony actually would have demonstrated. The appellant is suggesting that they suggest order when, in fact, this was just this lawless command where people sort of wandered in every few months wearing bearskins and that there was no accountability at all. But, in fact, HM1 Odom testified that when he was taking accountability, and the muster reports do indicate some occasions where he left names off, but he wasn't marking people present that were not present, and he was only marking late-stay special detail when they were absent if he had spoken to that person. Now, he was the one for BS and PG and who had muster reports associated with their treatment, and nothing in his testimony indicated that he would have marked appellant present when he wasn't or absent if he was there. So with regards to at least those two records, his testimony suggests that the records were reliable and it would not have undermined the quality of the record.
Well, testimony, they got ripped by the command because this was so sloppy.
Your Honor, he testified that there were a couple of incidences
Yeah, where they got ripped by the command because the thing was so sloppy.
A couple of incidents, and his testimony suggests that it was when individuals were not marked UA when they should have been, basically. But again, there's nothing in his testimony that suggests he would have actually marked somebody UA when they weren't, or vice versa. Further, the fact that he noted those couple of incidents indicates that this was not the way that the records were created in the normal course of business. So merely those noting those two incidents would not have significantly undermined the value of the records in the members' minds if he had been able to testify.
But you're basing that on 39A testimony, not testimony that he was prohibited from giving because the military judge didn't grant what defense counsel was looking for.
That's correct, Your Honor. That testimony was provided in the 39A. But had he been able to give that testimony to the members, and we can know from his testimony what he would have told them, that would not have...
But the defense counsel might have tested in greater depth some of those assertions made during the course of proceeding in front of the members. So it's somewhat speculative exactly what would have developed.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but there's nothing in the record to indicate that...
I think the point, counsel, is that you're better off not basing your argument on evidence that should have been subject to cross-examination.
I understood, Your Honor. It's simply a secondary argument to the fact that there was a mountain of cumulative evidence demonstrating that the appellant was, in fact, the offender here and that the muster reports were not necessary for members.
Given that it was not subjected to cross-examination, should it be considered in how high the mountain is that you're talking about? You're saying there's a mountain of evidence, but to build that mountain, you're using the evidence that's the subject of the appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. If there was a constitutional violation here, the United States recognizes that we have to demonstrate...
Are you seriously contending that this was consistent with due process to allow this evidence to go to the panel without an opportunity for cross-examination by the defense?
Under these limited circumstances, Your Honor...
Under what limited circumstances? That's at least three times you've used the phrase limited circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor.
What limited circumstances is it that makes this an appropriate process?
First, when it occurred after the close of the evidence. And
that would seem to cut against you, because after the close of the evidence, it's a little extraordinary to bring new evidence. I know the panel can request it, just like the jury can in civilian, but usually what they're requesting is in evidence. Come in with new evidence after they've gone out. That doesn't help you. What is the limited circumstance that makes it okay to not allow cross-examination?
Your Honor, in the United States position, it's merely that it was those... It was only the items that the members requested that were admitted, and they were non-testimonial business records. But under those limited circumstances, he was not...
I'm not sure how that helps it to be due process. The fact that they requested it would seem, if anything, to make it seem like it's important evidence. The panel cared about it. How does that help you establish that the due process doesn't require a cross-examination, right?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that factor that the members asked for it specifically indicates that it doesn't violate due process. However, I would note that is...
You're suggesting that's a circumstance that makes it consistent with due process to have the examination. I don't see how, what's your basis, what seems to be a complete non sequitur. You said they requested it. Therefore, they don't have to give the cross-examination. That faithfully, the therefore in there is escaping me. What?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that help your case?
I understand that you do not accept the United States position. There's nothing more that I can offer you on that point.
Okay.
With your permission, I would like to address the fact that the members did request this and why that doesn't indicate that this actually prejudiced the appellant. So what the members requested was all the documentary evidence that had been mentioned in the trial but had not actually been provided to the members. They were asking for the NCIS reports, the counseling sheets, et cetera. It indicates that the members wanted to be thorough. And further, the Child Defense Council had seemed to suggest that either the United States didn't have this, or perhaps it contained something they didn't want the members to see. So, indeed, it undermined his argument in that point, but it was not important evidence for the members' consideration, given the substantial other evidence of his identification.
Well, that raises an interesting point. The members originally asked not just for these things, but a bunch of other stuff, which wasn't in evidence. Eventually they hashed it out and came down to these. But what does the fact that the members requested all this other stuff that wasn't in evidence say about the strength of the government's case?
Your Honor, it suggests that the members were attempting to be thorough. So, and in particular, the only real way that the appellant was attacking the United States case was on the identification piece, and the muster reports were the only thing that were even relevant to identification. But as previously stated, under the circumstances, they could not have been important to the members' decision, particularly in light of what they did respecting the victim OLS.
Okay, what? Go ahead.
We don't know why they did what they did with OLS. We don't know what they based their decision on in that instance.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, none of us was in the deliberation room.
It could have been a reason completely unrelated to identification.
That's certainly possible, Your Honor. However, one does have to note that the muster reports did specifically implicate exclude HM3 Fillage and implicate the appellant, and OLS was unable to make an eyewitness identification in that case. Your Honor,
real quick question. Looking at the defense's closing argument, and this goes to whether it was error in the first instance to allow these records to go in, it seems that the defense's argument was, and I quote, if he had the records, I assume he would have produced them in court.
Yes,
so that's what he said after the close of all the evidence. And then, voila, right? The members asked for the records, and they're produced.
Yes,
you don't see that as problematic?
No, Your Honor. Not when the trial defense counsel used them in a fairly limited manner and simply suggested the United States had not met its burden by not providing everything to the members.
If he had the records, I assume he would have produced them, right? Suggesting that they didn't have the records.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? And in fact, the records had not been introduced as evidence, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then the members asked for them, perhaps testing this theory after the entire case is over and the military judge produces them.
Yes, Your Honor, but that in itself would not indicate error, particularly where the appellant had suggested that they didn't exist, and the members were only asking for documents that had previously been mentioned in the court martial. So the rule that members can request additional evidence is always out there. And to an extent, the trial defense counsel assumes risk that the members will ask for something he mentions that the government has not yet provided.
Well, but the judge is the gatekeeper, is
yes,
he
sir.
Not? And here the judge just tossed them at the members and said, here they are. Do something with them.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Not in those words, but yes, Your Honor. But under the circumstances where the United States had demonstrated the appellant's identity beyond any reasonable doubt, even without the muster reports were simply unimportant and did not contribute to the convictions here. And if there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Any questions? Okay, thank you. That concludes presentation of the case. The court thanks counsel, and we will be in recess until 10:20.